Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, these are stories that keep you informed. Coming up on the program today, the Democratic Alliance turns up the heat, exits national talks, and eyes a no-confidence vote in the president. But the presidency is pushing back. Ramaphosa says he won't be bullied and says the DA must make its choice. Visa delays and red tape declared unlawful and mining squeezed by costs, but opportunity knocks for bold investors. It's Monday, the 30th of June. In the wake of Andrew Whitfield's dismissal by President Ramaphosa and Fikile Mbalula's challenge overnight for the DA, and I quote, to pack its bags and leave the GNU, the DA, as you know, has chosen to stay in the coalition government, but with heavy fire aimed at the ANC. I'm in conversation now with Federal Chair Helen Ziller, and let's discuss what the next moves are this week. So, Helen, welcome to you. The ANC Secretary General overnight, as you've heard, has dared the party to pack its bags. What do you say to the Secretary General in reply?
Well, the Secretary General knows very well what the consequences will be if the DA leaves the government. That's why they won't fire us. They know exactly that it will mean the rand will crash, the economy will crash further, unemployment will skyrocket, investment will be pulled out, we'll probably be taken out of AGOA, there'll probably be tariffs, punitive tariffs from the US. The DA actually covers the country from all of that by being in the GNU. So we have to decide on a commensurate response when this kind of thing happens. Now, Andrew Whitfield was fired for literally no reason. It was not an official government trip. It was a private DA trip, despite the fact that he didn't have to apply. He did apply. He got no reply from the president, and he was fired. And as you know, there are people in the ANC government whose behavior is so egregious that they wouldn't have survived any other government anywhere in the world. And we had to decide on a commensurate response for that. Now, obviously, bringing the government down and having all of that trauma rain down on South Africa is probably not a commensurate response for the firing of a deputy cabinet minister. But what we do think is appropriate is to withdraw from the national dialogue, because all of this talking actually brings no progress for South Africa. And this is just the ANC's 2026 election campaign in disguise. So we're withdrawing from that. And we are going to vote against the budget votes of all the implicated ministers, those that are implicated in corruption. Mm.
How difficult is it going to be for your party to operate within the structure of the GNU, given that you now appear to be the de facto opposition sitting in cabinet?
Yes, we've had to have been from day one, because we drew up a statement of intent against a terrible deadline imposed by the country's constitution. But we nevertheless got a workable statement of intent that provides protection for smaller parties. The ANC has ignored that from the beginning, completely ignored every single clause of it. Now they're jumping up and down and saying, in that statement of intent, there's a national dialogue. Yes, there is. But the national dialogue, according to the statement of intent, has to be a joint decision and negotiated between the different parties, not a unilateral imposition by the ANC as it has been. So the ANC has ignored and violated every clause of that statement of intent, including bloating the cabinet beyond what was agreed in order to get more of their CADA ministers in, deployed into government. So they've ignored it from the beginning, and we can't just sit there and be messed around like this. So we are going to be the opposition in government.
How effectively can you work within those structures that you've just outlined to me?
Well, our ministers are being very effective, doing what they need to do. And we continue working like that. But the big things we're battling to get done, so we're finalizing a rescue package for our economy, and we're going to fight on those points day and night. The ANC knows what the consequences will be if they chuck us out and if we leave the government, because the DA is the only hope that investors, that the economy, that international community has for South Africa. The fact that the DA is in the coalition, they would never kick us out. They want us to leave so that we get the blame. We're saying we're not leaving, but we're going to fight for the statement of intent while we are here. We are not going to let this crisis rain down on South Africa by leaving, but believe me, we're going to stand up very firmly for our rights under the statement of intent, because it has Fikile Mbalula's signature on it. And, you know, Fikile Mbalula's signature is not worth the paper that it's written on. I don't know if any of them have actually read the statement of intent.
Helen Siller, does your party believe that Cyril Ramaphosa is still the right GNU leader, or is your support either run out or running out quickly?
Well, no one in the ANC is the right leader. The trouble is, nearly 40% of the country voted for President Ramaphosa, so they must think he's the right leader. We certainly don't.
In terms of your leverage that you have you miscalculated it? If the ANC runs the GNU without you, what would that mean?
Well, we did a lot of the mathematics around a vote of no confidence in the president, and we came up with about 196 votes. Or 197 votes, depending on what the smaller parties does. Now, you obviously need 201 votes out of a 400-member parliament to take a vote of no confidence over the edge. We're very close to that now, and the president just has to irritate a few more people for us to be there. And if there was a secret ballot, he would be out on his nose overnight, because half his own caucus would vote against him. So the important point is this: we are loading a motion of no confidence. We didn't think a motion of no confidence would be appropriate in the event of the sacking of a deputy minister, however spurious the reasons given, but it's definitely an option on the table, and we will always make the response commensurate with the infringement.
So what's the concrete red line here that you've drawn before you would implement that motion?
Well, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. But there's no end to the egregious things that the ANC can do.
Helen Siller, thank you very much indeed. All right, I want to stay with the issue, and listening to that conversation is Vincent Magwenya, who speaks for the presidency. Vincent, a very warm welcome to you. And broadly, this fight, I would suggest to you, is not good for the government of national unity or South Africa. As far as the presidency is concerned, do you believe that all trust is now broken between the two principal parties in the GNU?
No. First of all, good day, Jeremy, and good day to your listeners. No, Jeremy. I think with the benefit of time, our colleagues from the DA will enhance their own understanding of government and its processes, particularly the rules that govern the running of cabinet, as well as the rules that members of the national executive are expected to abide by. And once that happens, these kinds of infringements will be minimal. It's unfortunate that whenever there's an issue, the DA chooses to amplify it and comes up with all sorts of threats and so on, which, as you saw, the president was not moved by any of those threats. And so the president believes there's still room to work with the DA within the context of the GNU. At the same time, a level of maturity is going to be required from all parties, including the DA in particular, to understand that it cannot appropriate to itself a level of superiority above everyone else, whether that be on the economy or on how government needs to run. It's a partnership, and everybody needs to work within that partnership. However, the rules are rules, and those rules cannot be disobeyed simply because a member of the national executive comes from the DA.
But Vincent, how on earth can that work if you heard Helen Ziller saying that the DA is effectively going to be in opposition within government?
Well, you know, that's not going to work. And that, for us, is nothing short of sloganeering. In practice, in terms of how government functions, there's a level of cooperation that is required. There is a level of diligence in executing the authority that is delegated to individual ministers and other members of the national executive. And so you're not going to have a case where the president will tolerate ministers that will outrightly be insubordinate or defy those established rules. They took an oath as ministers of state. And so that's nothing short of sloganeering, but in practice it will not work. I'll give you an example. The president has been very supportive of the kind of reforms that Minister Schreiber is continuing on that were started by Minister Motsoaledi. And Minister Schreiber has engaged the president on some of these reforms, and the president has lended his support to them. And so in terms of the actual work of government, there will always be a level of cooperation between the president and all the ministers he has appointed into the national executive.
Vincent, how can President Ramaphosa tolerate ministers, though, within his own cabinet? These are ANC ministers who are effectively accused of corruption. This is surely double standards.
Well, there's a little bit of complexity there, Jeremy, that needs to be appreciated when assessing those matters. That a lot of those matters are still being dealt with within due process, right? So, for example, if you want to pick up on anybody that was mentioned on the Zondo report, they've taken the Zondo report on review. So there's still a due process exercise that's underway. Any action while those processes are underway will be deemed unfair by those individuals. If you want to debate the Simelane issue, for example, those are infringements that happened when she was mayor of Polokwane and there was a sanction that was leveled by the appropriate authority at the time. And recognizing the potential conflict of interest if the matter, as the matter is still being investigated more broadly around VBS and what happened, the president moved the minister to another portfolio so that there's no conflict there. And so I think we're conflating issues and we're using generic references without looking at matters on merit and in specific terms.
I want to pivot the conversation slightly if I can. You would have seen overnight President Trump has reiterated his stance on not attending the G20, again blaming victimization of white people in this country. Does the presidency have any further view on this?
Oh no, I missed that, Jeremy. I was traveling from Spain after the president cancelled his visit there. Our expectations were not that high in any case that he will attend. The president had made an appeal that the U.S. Played a leading role in the formation of the G20, and therefore it will be really good that when he hands over the presidency of the G20, he does so to his American counterpart. But if President Trump has chosen not to recognize that significance and does not come, the summit will continue and the summit will come to its rightful conclusion. And when the U.S. is hosting the G20, President Ramaphosa will attend and participate as he's done with all other G20 members during his term of office.
But what does Trump's absence signal about the credibility and global weight of this G20 summit under our leadership?
Well, there are 20 countries, plus the EU, plus the African Union, which was admitted in India. I don't think the entire forum is going to be collapsed by the absence of one country. If the US reduces its participation in the G20, that will be consistent with the attitude we've seen coming out of the Trump administration towards a lot of the multilateral sort of platforms and organizations. We've seen a level of hostility towards the UN and some of its agencies. And so that would be consistent with that kind of posture that we've observed. But from our side, we're not concerned because it will not collapse the entire summit. Other countries will participate and they will ensure that they get something meaningful out of it.
Will it make it more difficult for South Africa to use this event to assert relevance on the world stage in spite of the snub?
Well, it's not so much South Africa asserting it's relevant. It's more the globe coming together to collaborate and continue partnering in resolving major issues that are affecting the world. And so it's actually incumbent upon the U.S. to decide what its role in the world is going to be. Are they going to forge a constructive role that seeks to collaborate with other countries in looking at the various challenges facing the world, or are they going to isolate themselves? And so really the pressure is on the U.S. And the question of relevance actually applies to the U.S. more so than it applies on South Africa. We continue to play a very active and meaningful role in various multilateral platforms, and our contribution is felt, and where people don't feel that we are engaged enough, they call on us to be involved. And so the question of relevance falls on this global superpower that is seemingly distancing itself from the rest of the world. Whilst it needs the world for its own survival, it cannot survive on its own. And so I think the question should be posed the other way around. On our side, we are maintaining the same posture informed by our constitutional principles as well as our foreign policy to advocate and advance an agenda that will see us living in a better Africa and a better world.
Vincent Magwenya, thank you very much indeed. He speaks for the presidency.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
It's a court ruling with wide-reaching implications for anyone applying for a South African visa from abroad. The High Court has ordered the Department of Home Affairs to stop adding unofficial hurdles to visa applications, like demanding long-term lease agreements which have no basis in law. Now, the ruling follows a case involving the South African High Commission in Cameroon, where an applicant for a critical skills visa was denied the chance to even submit his application. Now, the court has not only ordered the mission to process that application within 10 days, I understand, but has also warned that non-compliance could trigger contempt of court proceedings. It's a strong signal that gatekeepers practices at South African foreign missions must fall in line with the Immigration Act and all ministerial directives. I want to explore this in a little further detail now. I'm in conversation with Adil Wadi, immigration consultant and the legal representative in this matter. Adil, a very warm welcome. So first of all, maybe just an overall sense from you. Is this ruling a one-off, or do you think it's the start of a systemic cleanup at foreign missions as far as visas are concerned?
Thank you, Jeremy, and thanks for having me today on the show. Jeremy, I think as a starting point, the first thing is that it's not a common case for us to take the Department of Home Affairs to the High Court in South Africa for missions abroad. However, in this instance, because of what had happened and because of the position that the applicant had held, he was supposed to be employed as the chief financial officer in South Africa. And because of that, it was decided by the company that we cannot wait any longer in order for us to try and get this application in. So I wouldn't say it's the start of a change whereby the High Court is going to be our new route in order to get applications in. But what it was the fact that in this instance specifically, is that with regards to this applicant, we had to approach the High Court in order to try and get something out of them in order for this applicant to have his application submitted.
And Adil, in that respect then, how widespread are these unauthorized documentation demands from consulates?
Yes, fantastic question. So I think on that, the first thing is that we have to commend the Department of Home Affairs and Minister Schreiber for what they've done since he's taken office. He has basically come in with fresh ideas. He's come in, he's cleared the visa backlog. He's ensured the continuation of the trusted employee scheme, etc. But what we have seen is that it's taking either a very long time or it's being ignored completely by our missions and embassies abroad, whereby he might implement changes in South Africa, but abroad it doesn't seem to be implemented as quickly as what we thought it would. So it's not just related to the Cameroon itself. It's widespread throughout the world where applications or applicants who are trying to submit outside of South Africa are struggling with requests for documents which are not in any relation to the Immigration Act, its accompanying regulations. It's just basically done by the official on the day. We've seen them change from day-to-day basis where you can submit today and there is no request for something, and then you attend the center tomorrow and there's a completely new request for something which isn't required in terms of the Act.
And why? Why does this kind of practice happen, do you think?
So we think, I don't think it's a communication delay, because we know for a fact that the department does address all these concerns with the embassies abroad. We've seen it insofar as towards the end of last year, the minister issued a directive to embassies abroad to let them know that requesting for additional documents which aren't required in terms of the Act or its accompanying regulations is completely against what they should be doing abroad. The directive was obviously issued only in terms of visitors' visas for 11 months. It wasn't addressed as a widespread for all visa types. But the fact is that the department is aware that this is happening. They are aware that embassies abroad are making it extremely difficult for applicants to submit. But it comes down to the mere fact that either they are just going against what the department is actually trying to do, which is to make it easier for the mobilization of applicants to South Africa, or it's just something which the embassies abroad and the officials are just reluctant to change the process, which has been the same for them for so many years, and they're scared to implement something such as, for example, a radiological report no longer being needed. They are scared to accept an application and adjudicate it without that because they are so used to what it was like a year or two ago.
The problem, of course, is whether this order is going to lead to meaningful enforcement or simply be ignored again in the future.
Of course, of course. So on that, we definitely take this court order as a landmark decision. It's a decision which can be used and referenced by applicants in the future because of the significance it holds. Obviously, with regards to the fact, as you mentioned previously, is that they were given 10 days in order to accept this application, which shows how the court views this matter to say that it's not something which we are telling you guys you can have maybe a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks in order to decide what you want to do. We've given you a set amount of time in order to rectify this. And if you don't rectify it, there will be repercussions. So on that basis, any future application or any future applicant who is trying to submit and is met with these sort of requests or requirements from the officials can definitely reference this order because of its landmark decision, so that they can use it in order to get the applications in.
So let's talk about repercussions then. Do you believe that legal or disciplinary consequences should apply to officials who are essentially acting ultra vires?
Of course, of course. So one of the key things with regards to the order is that if the mission abroad refuses to accept the application within the 10 days, is that we can reapproach the High Court for contempt of court order. And what that essentially basically means is that should the embassy not accept the application, we can request for the minister to be held in contempt, which then means he can be jailed for up to a period of 90 days. Obviously, that is the last resort. It's the last thing we would want out of this whole situation. But with the severity of what they are doing abroad, it is necessary that we have to take extreme legal measures to ensure that these applications are adjudicated in line with both the Act and the
And
regulations.
just a quick one in conclusion, do you have a sense of how many visa applicants have been unfairly blocked in this way in the past?
I wouldn't be able to give you an exact figure, but what I can tell you is that it's, like I said, it's not just specific to a specific region within, for example, Africa or Europe. It's across the world, and sometimes within specific countries, there is more than one mission whereby one is completely fine, whereas if you go to the next mission, there is a complete change with regards to what they want to request in order for you to apply. So it is something we're seeing across the world. It's not specific to any region whatsoever, and it's also not specific to in terms of the missions, it's not everyone. For example, if you go, like I said, on a day, there might be an official who is completely in line with what needs to happen. Yet the next day, there is a different official who does come on the day and request extreme amount of additional documents, which doesn't make any sense as they're not part of the regulatory requirements.
Adil Wadi, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The global mining industry is under pressure. Rising costs, tighter margins, and geopolitical risks all squeezing profitability across the board, except and notably for gold. But amidst the turbulence, new strategic opportunities are emerging. All of that is according to PwC's latest Mine 2025 report. Andres Rousseau, PwC Africa's leader for utilities and resources, is with me now to discuss the data to help us understand where the mining sector is headed in a world which is increasingly being shaped by climate, tech, and geopolitics. So, Andres, a very warm welcome. The top 40 mining companies listed in your survey saw EBITDA drop by 10% last year. What's the assessment here? Is this a warning signal or simply part of a longer-term cycle, do you think?
Yeah, so the revenue and EBITDA for those companies, excluding the gold companies, dropped by 3% and 10% respectively. And it's in line with expectations from the prior year, where we said we know commodity prices are down, input costs are increasing, and therefore we've got that margin squeeze. The positive thing, I think, for 25 is that we are seeing a bit of a stabilization in the input cost. And although commodity prices are still under pressure, there's hope for, let's call it a stabilization in earnings levels or profit levels.
What, in your opinion, explains gold's standout performance in a very constrained environment? What are the underlying drivers?
Yeah, so just to put gold in perspective, gold revenues went up by 15%, and the EBITDA margin for the gold companies was sitting at 32% versus 22% for the overall position. So clearly a standout performance. And it's risk aversion. The global investment community, and that includes central banks in the main, are putting their money in gold in these uncertain times. So perhaps a move from dollar reserves to gold reserves is one of the main drivers for gold's big run.
And we're also seeing a spike in palladium and platinum at the moment.
Yeah, very happy. Look, the PGM basket price has been at real-time lows that we saw in 2015 and 2016. It's long overdue for recovery. We've had supply less than demand for a number of years, and stock levels just ran out. So the timing of the recovery, no one could forecast, but certainly in line with expectations that it would be growing.
But Andres, broadly, the rest of the sector is certainly bleeding margin. Are we at the risk of major players starting to scale back operations radically or even cutting jobs? Or is it too soon to make that call?
No, I don't think we're at the scale back levels yet. I mean, in South Africa, certainly in the PGM sector, we've seen those scale backs, but the current price recovery will hopefully stop that, or at least temporarily put a halt to it. What we are seeing, though, is lack of capital investment. So we're not replacing the existing mines with new mines, and that's a problem for the longer term. So not losing jobs now, but not creating the jobs for the long-term future sustainability. And when mines close, they close. Though.
Your report also highlights something called concentration risk. In that respect, how exposed is South Africa in this regard, and particularly when it comes to critical minerals?
Yeah, South Africa is actually one of those top countries where concentration risk is certainly found, because we are main providers of PGMs, manganese, vanadium, and a number of others. So we are a country that should be important to the world in the supply of the critical minerals that we do supply into the world basket. If we say how exposed are we in terms of sourcing of metals, then I think we're reasonably okay, but global supply chains are disrupted, and that does have cost implications for us too.
And the broader picture in terms of geopolitical risk, so ongoing trade disputes, regional conflicts in many parts of the globe, that is also no doubt shifting the center of gravity when it comes to mining.
It is. And what we are seeing is a number of countries implementing incentives and the like in order to secure supply. Tariffs is just one of those means to try and do it. The global trade war is not good for the mining industry. Generally, products are exempted, but the reality is that it's put a bit of a break on global growth, and the mining industry needs global growth in order to fuel demand, and therefore the price is under pressure, as we are seeing for most commodities.
And Andres, your report raises the very important issue of this country trying to transition to greener energy, all well and good, but mining obviously is still a carbon-intensive industry, and there must be questions around whether those two goals can coexist.
Well, they can. We, for the energy transition to happen, we need more mining and not less. All the critical minerals, rare earths that we need, more copper, etc., in the energy transition needs to be mined. It's not going to appear from anywhere. Mining companies have done very well, especially in our country, to add renewable energy projects to their input for electricity. You can think of the large scale wind and solar farms that mining companies have built, sometimes behind the meter, others with wheeling arrangements. But the industry in South Africa has actually done very well to supplement Eskom supply with green energy. It's important on the one side to help the country and security of supply. On the other side, with CBAM looming and carbon tax exports, the more they can supply themselves with green energy, the better, from a long-term point of view.
And talking of security of supply, we obviously know about infrastructure failure in this country, rail bottlenecks, and these ongoing logistic constraints are, I'm sure, eroding the value of what we can optimally extract from mining. That remains a big issue, doesn't it?
There's no doubt. Countries that create appropriate enabling environments for the mining industry to function, and that includes things like electricity, water, and mine-to-market infrastructure, are certainly a better place to attract investment if they've got the resources for it. By not having the infrastructure or having the failing infrastructure that we are experiencing in the country, it adds a lot to the cost base. And it's fair to say that mining companies that are investing in renewables at the moment would have preferred not to if the country could supply electricity. They would rather want to invest their hard-earned money into new mining projects or new mining investments. But it's also important to note that collaboration between government and the mining sector has been good, and it has been addressing a number of the infrastructure constraints that we are experiencing in the country.
And all of that is contained in PwC's latest Mine 2025 report. I've been in conversation with Andres Rousseau, PwC Africa Leader for Utilities and Resources. Andres, thank you. And that's where we are going to leave it for this Monday, the 30th of June. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.